Hello and welcome to Cruise Club. We've got the need to podcast. This is episode 41, American Made from 2017. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
Mike, we are guestless today. We had another scheduling issue. We're going to have our guest back on either Top Gun 2 or Mission Impossible 7. I guess whichever comes out first, probably Top Gun 2. Who knows when that'll be supposed to be out this summer, but you know, the world reshuffles the deck sometimes.
Yeah, plans change.
So American Made Cruise's next to last most recent movie, penultimate movie.
Crazy.
If I don't know how, that's not exactly the right thing, but he's only got one more movie after this. We're covering next week Mission Impossible Fallout. Then we will be caught up on Mr. Tom Cruise. But Mike, before we get into what American Made, you know, our favorite parts, least favorite parts, here is what the plot is about. And this, I basically wrote down almost a full page, single space, and then I basically halved it. There's a lot going on here, I think. Again, shouldn't be a surprise. The movie begins in 1978. Cruise plays a bored pilot named Barry Seal, who's looking like he's Maverick all grown up, kind of, even though it's before Maverick, but just pretend it's, okay. Domhnall Gleeson plays CIA agent Monty Schaefer, or maybe not, who knows, who is Schaefer? He recruits Cruise to the CIA. Cruise is married to Sarah Wright, who plays Lucy Seal. Cruise's work includes taking pictures of insurgents, becoming a bag man for the CIA. He also partners with the Medellin cartel, to smuggle cocaine into the U.S. The cartel gets busted and Cruise is arrested. Gleeson saves him because Reagan wants a war in Nicaragua and they need Cruise. Then, looking down the barrel of a raid, Cruise moves his family to Mena, Arkansas overnight. Cruise then becomes arming freedom fighters, or what the U.S. wants to make freedom fighters, to Nicaragua with AK-47s. He also starts flying the Contras up to the U.S. for training. Really, he's bringing the guns down to his cartel buddies, getting paid there, getting paid basically by everyone. Cruise begins playing everyone with one goal in mind, get really rich really fast. Things go well, but they go too well. He has too much money and too much attention. Lucy's brother JB, played by the incredible Caleb Landry Jones, shows up and causes some trouble. He gets arrested, and after Cruise bails him out and gives him an ultimatum, he's killed in a cartel car bomb. Eventually, the CIA gets tired of the Cruise headache. Basically, Ethan Hunt has gone rogue, and they're tired of dealing with it. The CIA, ATF, state police, and FBI all converge to arrest Cruise at the same time. He then kind of does his Jack Reacher thing as he tells everybody he's going to get freed. He's leaving. He's right. The White House and also Governor Clinton, future President Bill Clinton, bail him out, bust him out, so he can help them prove the Sandinistas in Nicaragua are the ones dealing drugs. The trip starts off rocky, but things go well, but then his face is shown on the nightly news as Ronald Reagan tells about the crack epidemic or the war on drugs. The feds then raid Barry's place, and he gets sentenced to 1,000 hours of community service, no jail time. Cruise then begins motel hopping, living a life where he's afraid to start his car, recording his tapes that have been playing sort of all movie long, telling a story, until he gets killed in his car by hitmen sent by Pablo Escobar. Domhnall Gleeson, his next bright idea is to get Iran to arm the Contras. I'm sure that'll turn out well. And that's American Made.
Nice. Good summation. Nice going.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, there is a lot going on. Once again, I mean, it wouldn't be a Tom Cruise movie if there wasn't, like, a whole lot of shit happening.
And it wouldn't be a modern Tom Cruise movie if he wasn't dating a 33-year-old leggy blonde.
But we also have Doug Liman back directing here, which I totally forgot about, which is great, right?
Yeah, man. Back from Edge of Tomorrow. It's a nice partnership between him and Cruise. I think it works really well. I think that in both those movies, Cruise seems to be having fun.
Playing a little off-type in both movies as well.
Yes, for sure. There seem to be two different kinds of Cruise movies lately, in this decade, kind of, right? In the last decade, there's either the ones that are not exactly surefire hits, where things don't quite align, or ones like this that sort of feel like a perfect summation of his career. Like, this kind of feels like a distillation of, like, a lot of things that he's known for, all kind of jam-packed into one specific part, one specific movie.
But this is definitely that kind of role, right? Like, that kind of sort of biopic, that kind of, like, I mean, it's very Charlie Wilson-esque almost. Like, it's very sort of like, we gotta find a big star to play this guy. Like, this story in particular is, like, so incredible and amazing and stuff. You need, like, an action star to kind of jump in these shoes to make it feel a little more interesting or something like that. But yeah, I loved it though. I love basically like just about everything about this movie. Like I think I sort of leading up to this one, I was sort of hinting that it's one of my favorite Cruise films.
Yeah, so what do you love about it? What's your favorite part of American Made?
I mean, there's so many like great moments, but like I just love like right off the bat how the movie sets you in a time and place like so perfectly. Like this is a period piece, but it's only like the late 70s. It goes a long way in showing like how much has actually changed or like aesthetically, you know, with with like the logos right out of the gate, right when the movie starts, and maintain sort of the look and the grain of that era of film. And I feel like it tries to emulate that type of filmmaking along the way. I love how this is sort of one of those black ops movies again, you know, again, like Charlie Wilson's, like, this is just like it seems like it's been declassified recently. And so, like, now we can learn about it. So, like, all the espionage, and it's fun and funny as hell. You know, it's not perfect, but, like, I just love so much about it. And think, like you said, like, it's almost like this perfect storm of Cruise, of, like, all the things that he's really good at crammed together. Like, I almost thought it might be Overload. Coming back to it just for my second full viewing, like, I didn't feel that at all. Like, I really enjoyed it again, front to back again.
So this is, I don't know if you know this, but this is, you know, in terms of the declassified nature of this all, do you know this is like the third time or something, that at least the third time that Barry Seal's story has been told?
I absolutely did not. This is the first time I ever heard of it.
So in the early 90s, there was an HBO movie called Double Crossed, and he was played by Dennis Hopper.
Whoa, okay.
In 2016, The Infiltrator, he was played by Michael Paré. The important thing, I think, in both of those, or at least specifically The Infiltrator, is that Barry Seal looked nothing like Tom Cruise. He was a big, heavyset guy nicknamed El Gordo, which aka the Fat One. That's what the Medellin cartel called him. And Barry Seal was slightly more accurately embodied by Michael Paré in The Infiltrator.
I wonder if that was a joke in this movie when they're on the runway and he looks in and there's that big fat guy in the co-pilot seat and he's like, this dude's fat as hell or whatever.
This guy's fatter than fuck. Either I fly the big fella or I fly your product.
That's interesting, though, because, you know, like, I didn't question for a minute. Like, I didn't go look and Google this up. Like, it fell into the territory for something that you kind of enlightened me about a couple films back when it comes to based on a true story, is that it never went beyond the point of disbelief concerning the limits of this character. Like, it never... You know what I'm saying? Like, it set up a character to the point where, like, he never did anything that I didn't believe would have been done in real life. Like, I actually considered this to probably be toned down, if anything, and whatever was made up was sort of legit to the character's traits and all that kind of stuff anyway. Him not being portrayed like a big fat guy or whatever, El Gordo or El Lardo or whatever, like, I'm cool with that, because everything else sort of, like, falls into place for me, like, cinematic.
I mean, I have to imagine that's absolutely true. Like, this is the kind a movie where you watch it and it's fun for most of the time, and you're having a good time watching Tom Cruise basically become rich overnight and just, you know, pull one over. Like, it's basically like Uncut Gems, like Adam Sandler Uncut Gems. He's like mortgaging, he's like robbing Peter to pay Paul. He's like, all right, I gotta get this money over here, so I gotta mortgage this necklace, but now the guy wants the necklace back, so I gotta get another necklace, then mortgage that necklace to get the necklace back. And like, he's like just always barely one step ahead, but not quite. And you watch it and you're like, God damn it, just like stop, just stop, just stop. Like, but like, you have enough. You have more than enough. Like, just pull, like, stop. People don't know everything about you. Like, go into hiding. Like, you know, Sarah Wright wasn't excited to move to Mena, Arkansas, and then you build her this palatial estate. Like, you could do the same thing somewhere else. Like, just get out of there. But then you think it's kind of like the Walter White, the Heisenberg thing, where it's like, once you begin down a path, you can't. There's the ego, there's the addiction, and you just gotta see it through to the end. And it's fun to watch, but at the whole movie, I'm just like, you have enough.
It is. It does fall into one of those categories of, like, I am nerve-wracked, like, pretty much this entire film, because, like, Uncut Gems. Well, that movie more so, because that takes place in sort of a shorter time period. It's way more condensed and everything like that. What I think is interesting about this film is everybody on every level is like that. So when it comes to the cartel, they can't stop, right? And therefore Cruz can't, because they rely on him. And then the government can't stop what they're doing, because they're greedy as hell too. And, like, you know, they want their war and this, and he becomes this guy sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place, right? Like, he can't stop, or else, like, he's gonna get killed. But if he keeps going, he's gonna get killed. So, like, you just end up watching this guy get bled out, like, over the period of the movie, of, like, the course of his life. Just, like, you know, sure, he's got, like, you know, had the time of his life, I'm sure, but, like, cut short brutal and dramatically.
It really comes to a head at the end, where no matter who you're looking at, whether it's the cartel sending guys to kill him, whether it's Domhnall Gleeson basically saying burn him, we're done with him, whether it's the guys who are, like, celebrating that they got the pictures, but they're like, like, oops, didn't mean to share your face on the news. Sorry, man. Like, nobody cares if he lives or dies. He's just a pawn to the end. Like, he thinks he's the king of this world, and yet everybody's just like, oh, no, he's just the guy who does our dirty work. Like, we're not going to get touched. Like, we have a fall guy. We all have a fall guy, right? Like,
yeah.
The cartel doesn't have to do anything. Like, they just, you know, make the cocaine or, I don't know, harvest the cocaine, whatever. Then they're like, cool, you do the rest. And the drug dealer's like, we don't have to go get them. Like, we get the drugs, we do the rest. And it's just like, Tom Cruise is almost taking all the risk in all the places, but he's viewing it like he's got the upper hand, that he never does. Like, to your point, like, he's always, like, he's hemmed in at every corner. Like, he's always got his back against the wall, but he thinks he's the smartest man in the room. Like, he thinks he's Ethan Hunt, but he's not.
No, he's not. He's a dumbass, and his wife knows it. Like, what do you know about business? That sounds made up. Like, he's literally the fall guy, and then he falls for the story from the pitch. I love how well this movie is just, like, told from his character's perspective, too, to the point where, like, we start watching videotapes of him. Like, I think that's a very clever way of doing voiceover, too. But, like, he's one of, like, the probably, like, the least reliable narrators in film history. Like, who knows, like, what is real and false at some point? Like, the lines are so blurred and everything like that. It's what makes this movie great, but, like, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, I realized that watching this time, he's just, like, this two-bit smuggler. You know, like, he, from the jump, doesn't realize, like, the CIA has him by the balls because he's smuggling, like, Cuban cigars or whatever. Like, he doesn't realize, like, he's not off the hook for that from the, you know? And, like, I think he thinks he is. He's like, oh, I'm on your side now. It's like My Blue Heaven. Like, I'm undercover. I'm working with you guys. Like, I'm on the job. And then, like, at one point, Hall Gleason's like, you're not CIA,
you're
dude.
Not
like,
CIA, no.
He's like, you don't work for us, man. Like, we don't know you. You're disavowed or whatever. Like, yeah, he's got, like, these delusions of grandeur that are just, like, beautifully sort of translated.
I also do want to make sure that I say the exact line, because you keep, like, unintentionally cleaning up the lines. When she hears about the independent aviation consulting, Sarah Wright just says, well, that sounds fucking made up, Barry. It's just like, yeah, you're just a dumb, like, that's, it's not even, he's like, it's not, it wasn't his decision, right? That was Domhnall Gleeson, like, here's your company. And he's like, oh, cool. Like, all right, my whole company. And she's like, well, this is clearly fake. Like, what, who are you? Like, you're so dumb.
It's cool, man. Like, I think I brought up the film Blow before, also the Johnny Depp cocaine movie. Have you seen that film yet?
A long time ago.
That sort of falls into this same category, and I love, and even Boogie Nights, I feel, to a degree, where it's just like the excessive, can't get enough of the nature of all that, and then it all comes sort of crashing down around you, and you realize, like, oh shit, like, I've been living in this fantasy land, and, like, now I've got to run for my life. Oh no. Like, those kinds of movies are very, I like those kinds of movies a lot. They're pretty enjoyable.
I do want to give a special shout out to both Sarah Wright, well, especially Sarah Wright, because she is incredible as Cruise's wife in this movie. I knew her from, there was a show on NBC for 1 year called Marry Me. It was a show where Ken Marino and Casey Wilson were getting married. Did you see the show? Do you know about the show?
I've heard of that. I've heard the title, but I didn't even know Ken Marino was in it.
Yeah, it's Ken Marino and Casey Wilson, like, I think getting, like, preparing for their, I think in the first episode they get engaged or whatever, and the rest of this thing is just getting, I think, I don't remember exactly. I remember being very funny. I remember really enjoying it. But Sarah Wright plays Casey Wilson's, like, manic best friend, and she's great on that show. So when I saw this in theaters, you know, 2 or 3 years after Marry Me ended, I was like, oh, shit, like, I love her in this. I also really, really love, and I wish that she was in more, at the very end, the state attorney general, Jemma Mays. Like, yeah. She's great and everything, and I'm bummed that she only has one scene. To that end, you know, not just her, but, like, Jesse Plemons only has a scene and a half, right? Like,
oh,
there's so many people in this movie that are great. Caleb Landry Jones doesn't have enough.
I know.
Like, this is, I know this is the Tom Cruise show. Every other part that's filled out, like, they're all great.
It's tough because, like, I feel just by the nature of the story, like, the time setting, we're not going to get a lot of strong female characters. Like, sorry, it's just America at that time, which sucked. Also, it being such a Cruise vehicle, we're not going to be able to get people like Caleb Landry Jones or, you know, him and the sheriff. Like, they could have stolen this movie with their you know, hands tied behind their back. Like, the two of them in a movie together, I wanted, God, like, when they're on screen, it's just one of my favorite moments. What can I say? I don't know. But, like, you can't do anything but waste that kind of talent in a film like this because it's just such a Cruise explosion, I feel, from beginning to end. But it's great that they're here. I'd rather have them than not have them, than have, you know, someone I can't recognize.
100%. 100%. I'm trying to think what my favorite part of the movie is. I don't know that I have a favorite part. Like, I think this is the most fun you can have watching a movie that's basically the start of the crack epidemic in America. Like, it's like, this leads to terrible, terrible things, but, like, man, is it fun to watch.
Yeah.
There's two little things that I really love. There's one thing I really love. It takes what we saw in The Mummy to the next level, to literally the next level. It's crew. Okay, so this is.
I know exactly what you, I know there's exactly.
There's a little bit of wordplay here. All movie long, Cruise is telling these stories. He basically is narrating his autobiography to these tapes. He films himself in these motels as he's motel hopping. Essentially, the final month of his life, right? It's like January and February 1986, right before he dies, before he gets killed on February 16th. So if you know when he dies, you know exactly what these things are. Like, you could probably assume, based on just having seen movies. I also do wonder, so, like, he handwrites on one VHS, like, CIA 77 or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But that handwriting looks very similar to the title cards that come up. I wonder if Cruise handwrote those title cards, too.
Oh, it's Cruise font. That'd
maybe
be fun.
So he's narrating all this thing, and he's saying at one point, he's like, and I apologize that this is maybe a little graphic, but he says, I had my fingers in every pie on the rack, as he's basically sliding his hand up his wife's leg on a plane.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, okay. And then she gets on his lap while he's flying and they're having sex. And I'm like, this puts Han and Giselle making out on the Autobahn machine. And then they hit turbulence and they go into zero G. And they're basically like, they both reach climax. I will clean it up a little bit.
Nice.
While they're weightless. And I'm like, oh my God. And apparently, according to Doug Liman, he said the idea for that love scene was his idea, that he received the inspiration after he and Tom Cruise collided in the cockpit while filming a flight scene. So Doug Liman and Cruise bumped into each other, and he's like, I got it. You and your wife are going to have sex in the cockpit. But that also feels like, to your point from earlier, even if that didn't happen, that's absolutely something that Barry Seale would have wanted to do.
That's a great moment. That, like, personifies this guy so much, too. And it's in the middle of that amazing montage as well. I think it was like 1982 or 3 or something like that, where shit was just like off the chain and, you know, he's rolling as hard as possible and everything. But that's awesome. I also, another moment sticks out like that too, amongst like all the great ones, when he's coming back sort of later in the film and he's by himself and the DEA charges him to land. And at first they're sort of like doing like a Last Jedi thing where they're like outrunning him by going slow, mm-hmm. and waiting for him to like run out of gas.
Yes.
But
yep.
then they get a slow plane, and he's like, land immediately. He's like, you want me to land right now? Okay. And he just nosedives into the suburbs and lands on a street, like, with a bunch of houses and stuff. And that's where he crash lands, and he, like, hops out of it, and he's covered in coke. And he looks like a snowman or something. And he's just, like, digging money out of his bag, and he's giving it to these kids. He's like, this is for you, this is for you, this is for your bike. And he just, like, gets on some kid's bike, and he's just, like, pedaling away, like, covered in cocaine.
Leaving
what
a plane filled with cocaine and probably guns and probably money just in a residential neighborhood. Like, he's above the law, but he doesn't realize that he's above the law until the end. It's a very strange, precarious situation where he's in, but again, fun to watch.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and part of the character. Like, because later when he finally gets caught, they just let him go, right? So, like, if he did technically just get himself caught the first time, it would have saved all this aggravation, but he's kind of a dumbass. So, like, that's not the way he thinks. And that's a great way to sort of personify that sort of mind that he's working with.
Now, I have a lot of other little things that I really like about this movie that we can get to after this, but is there anything about this movie that you don't like? Do you have a least favorite part of American Made? Is there something about this that doesn't work for you?
So, I don't think there's any, like, specific moment. I think we'll bring back up when we get to sort of most wasted role, that might be a debate this movie, to be quite honest, because there's like the wife, the sheriff, and the wife's brother. Like, there's three characters right there who are like really, really great, you know, strong possibilities that are never really satisfied for me, you know. The Caleb Landry Jones character probably gets like the most arc or something, or conclusion, or maybe the wife, when she just like goes back to work at like the chicken shack or something, but like,
that's only at the end. I think that, like, mm-hmm. I think Caleb Landry Jones, like, for the fact that she's fourth lead, right, because there's probably Cruise and then Domhnall Gleeson and then Pablo Escobar and then her, mm-hmm. like, Caleb Landry Jones is no better than fifth, and I mean, just knowing him as the actor, when he shows up, you're like, oh boy, this is bad. Like, it's already bad, like, right?
Yeah,
like, it's
bad
from the beginning.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if he has an arc, but at least he has, like, payoff, right? Like, it's like, there's things that come to a head. He does things that are like, oh no, like, he just steals the money and he buys the gremlin. Like, all this stuff that just attracts attention. Even though they're not flying under the radar, he's still doing it wrong.
Exactly. And I think the only other thing, which isn't like a major thing, but as much as I love how fast top speed and fast paced this movie is, I think it goes in the beginning, I think it goes a little too fast. Like, I really wanted to see them explore a little more of like the pilot celebrity thing, because it kind of got me thinking of like, you know, Leo in Catch Me If You Can, where it's like, oh yeah, like pilots are like still revered. And I mean, even I'm sure at the end of the 70s, that was like coming to a close and all, but like, I wanted to see just a little more of before he got recruited, right? Like, maybe more of his family life, maybe more of, like, his wheeling and dealing on the side to sort of survive a little above his means, stuff like that. Just because when Domhnall Gleeson does recruit him, it's like all he has to say is CIA and that's it. And like, well, that's like, I get it. That's cool. And it's kind of timely. I just wish there was a little more, because I'm not sure exactly what the inciting incident is in this movie. There's like several in a row. I think it's when the cartel finally comes to him and says, you're working for us now, because then he has to sort of play both sides. And then the movie sort of kicks off for real and gets into like full gear. But that first sort of like act still feels a little sort of janky in places to me, you know, if I have to really like dig deep and think of something to come up with.
And I think that a lot of that is kind of masked by just like the kinetic energy of the filmmaking. Like,
oh,
the opening that you're talking about, where it like kicks back with the throwback to 70s music, and it goes from the modern Universal logo to the old Universal logo, which is something that we've talked about on Oblivion. Remember when Universal did it there? Mm-hmm. When we talked about it in Happy Death Day, Joe and I talked about it on Too Fast, Too Forever for the Cannonball Run. I think Smoking the Bandit has one, like just the little touches that are just like, oh no, like you can play with everything in your movie. Like you don't have to just have the Universal logo and then like that's part of your movie. Do something with it. And so between the music and the quick cutting and like the almost like the Office Parks and Rec like zoom in on like a reaction, like there's a lot of that kind of handheld-y like quick zoom. It's just like it feels docu-style sort of, but it's not, but it is.
Right.
And I think a lot of that like those flourishes kind of smooth over the fact that like we don't really know a lot to what you're saying about where he was before this all goes down.
And it's okay, because I think they rely on style a lot to sort of get you in your place. Like, there's a very sort of French Connection feel to a lot of the, like, the look of this movie as far as those sort of, like, punch-in zooms and things like that. I think that's where I sort of first noticed where it's like, oh, they're, like, shooting this movie like a documentary over, like, a fly on the wall kind of thing and stuff. And so, you're right, they have to do a lot, and there is a lot of information to convey. And this whole movie is basically just, like, new exposition every scene, right? So
yeah,
for what they've got to do, it's amazing like how well they've done it anyway. So that's why I just, you know, I definitely give them, wherever they trip up a little bit to begin with, just it ends, you know, by the end I'm just so satisfied.
If I have to pick something that I don't love, I think it's part of what I've been saying. I mean, there's two things, and they're neither, I think one is a personal thing and one is more of a thing that's similar to yours. The personal thing is just like, it makes me feel uncomfortable, which I know is not the movie's fault. Like, that's kind of maybe, but I just, like, I want to see movies without consequence, right? I want to see a movie where like, he just succeeds. He's just like, yeah, man, I'm the king. And then the movie ends. It's like, yeah, he is the king, right? Like, it's kind of like, I know that that's not a movie. Like, that's not, there's no conflict there, but like, you have that. And then it's like, ooh, like, just guys, stop. Just like, I just enjoy what you have. Beautiful wife, kids, beautiful house. Maybe get rid of Caleb Landry Jones. Sorry that he died, but like, you know, he's kind of trouble, whatever. Just enjoy what you have. Like, that's uncomfortable. Like, that's what I don't like about it. But I think more to your point about not knowing where he is, I feel like because the movie, like you said, has to have so much exposition, we don't always have, and also this movie's not crazy long, right? Like, it's an hour 45 without credits, I think, probably. So it's a pretty normal, tight-ish movie, you know, especially compared to Tom Hanks, Jesus Christ. But anyway, I feel like we don't know enough about, it feels like he gets both smarter and dumber as the movie goes on. He gets like more world, like wise to the world, but also like more cocky. I guess that makes sense, but I feel like we don't really see growth. We just see the effects of the growth, if that makes sense, right? He's just like, like, I don't think we establish why he's able to pull that Jack Reacher move. Like, where he's just like, I'm going to buy all you guys a Cadillac because I'm going to walk out of here. And they're like, no, you're not. And then, like, I don't know that we know. I think it's maybe that he assumes that he's important, and maybe that's enough. Mm-hmm. But I feel like there's, we don't have enough of, like, a trajectory for him. It's almost like we're skipping. Like, it's greatest hits. It's like, okay, here's this thing. And then here's this thing. And then here's this thing. And I think by doing the title cards with the year and with, like, what he's doing, kind of smooths that over. But I would have liked a little bit more maybe smoothing between to show how he gets from point A to B to C to D.
That's interesting, because it didn't really occur to me. I mean, it did, I think, while I was watching it, but not to really comment on. But, like, he doesn't really change as a person. He goes from being bored to, like, being over busy, like too busy, right? Like, yeah. To never board again for the rest of his life until he's shot. Him as a person never really changes. It's just like I said, like he goes from being bored to busy. There's nothing like wrong with that when Tom Cruise is playing that character and he's able to really bring that to life and keep you engaged in that for as long as possible. But I can see where that is sort of like a failing, because the movie never does really take a beat and rest and sort of like breathe, which is interesting. I never really considered that. And it's also really weird too, now that I think of it, is he not supposed to tell his wife what he's doing for a living, and yet how is she partying down with Escobar sometimes and then burying money in the yard and then kind of surprised when the cops are like banging on the door? You know, there's a little foggy logic going on with a lot of that too. But then again, like, I think they also do a really smart thing where if we ever question Doug Liman, he could always kind of go, well, you know, he's a very unreliable narrator, this guy, right?
Right.
Like, would you believe half the shit he told you? Maybe not, but like, it's a great story.
An issue that I have, not with movies like this, because I don't know, maybe movies like this, but if you look at a traditional biography, right, where it's like, if you tell a story like, okay, like Walk the Line or whatever, or like a movie where it's like, usually about musicians, at least that's the one I'm familiar with, where it's like, this is them as a kid, this is them when they're breaking into the business, this is when them at the top of their powers, this is the inevitable decline, this is the after the decline. It's like, this movie is 2 hours and it covers 80 years, and it's like, that's impossible. But then you have a movie like Lincoln, or you have a movie like Selma, where it's like, this is about a specific event in their lives, and it's basically a biopic, but it's not really. Like, it's not about Abraham Lincoln's life, but it's about that one part in time. Yeah. It's not about Martin Luther King's life, it's about his walk on Selma, right? Like, it works because it tells the story of that man within the context of, like, a specific, like, a career or a life-defining event, right? This is more like that first part, where it's not telling the entire life story, but it's telling like 8 or 10 years in 2 hours. Even though that's more condensed, it's impossible to tell that full story. And I think this does a better job, maybe because there's less time to cover, or because so much of it's just like an acceleration. It's not like going from like crazy thing to crazy thing, like all like disconnected. Like everything here clearly leads from one to the next. But I still feel like there's a little bit of that chaotic biopic kind of thing. I don't know what I'm looking at, but even though I know, I don't know what I'm looking at.
It's almost like kind of caught in the middle in a lot of weird ways, because like, we don't know this guy, so I could have used sort of like the teen years, like a scene of him as a kid, maybe like what was his home life like and all that kind of stuff. But yet it's doing sort of the Lincoln thing where it's like, we're just going to focus on this sort of like 5-6 years of his life, like the time where he became like the runner or the infiltrator or whatever they called him in the TV movie or whatever. So it's tough. It's like a mix of the beast. Like, I don't know, but I think they pulled it. Like, how else could you really do it? Like, I mean, whereas like, I would kind of like a videotape, like since we're doing like in the movie, he's doing this motif of all the videotapes and stuff, like they maybe could have cut in some home movies of him as a kid, like a little voiceover of, you know, that kind of shit. Done it that way. Snuck it in a clever way, but make it be sort of a mechanic of a more traditional biopic as opposed to one of these just like moment in my life versions kind of things. But
to the same end that you were saying before, like, this is not something that breaks the movie for me. I just think it's something that could have been maybe better. Although I don't know how you do this really. I mean, it's not easy to do. If it was easy to do, there'd be a lot more movies would be a lot better, right? Like, it's hard to do this kind of thing.
What would they do with an extra 20 minutes, half hour in here? You know, like all those things we mentioned kind of slow it down.
Right.
And is that, that's not really the movie anymore. And I think like, for what they wanted to make, I think you can feel like this is what they wanted to do, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're not really concerned with the things we're sort of bringing up. And, like, that's kind of cool. Like, I like that they know what they're doing, and I can feel
it. So some other things I want to point out, little things about this movie. So the opening, when there's the Jimmy Carter quote that's talking about, for the first time in our lives, you know, people think that the next 5 years is going to be worse than the previous 5 years, right? That whole thing about, like, the changing thing. That strikes a chord with me, because that is the quote that David Ehrlich used. I love David. I probably talked about it on Cruise Club. But at the end of every year, IndieWire film critic David Ehrlich makes a video montage of his 25 favorite movies of the year. And that was the quote that opened this year in movies. And I don't think I remembered where it was from. So I was like, oh shit, that's this. That kind of line, especially like how David Ehrlich used it. And I think it also could apply here. It was the beginning of the Trump era. And I think that there was a lot of unrest. And I feel like it was timely in that way, and I don't know if they added that in for this or they just framed it for, you know what I mean? Like, it could be in any number of things. You could read it any number of ways. It just, to me personally, I'm just, because I've seen that montage probably 40 or 50 times, right? Because I love those things, and I was like, oh, that's from this. Cool.
This is an extremely political movie without even trying. Like, and it's not trying to be. It just inherently is by the nature of the players involved, you know, when you're dealing with this on this scale globally and stuff. So, yeah, it's interesting that I never felt it being preachy or anything like that, but it's just funny when you see, like, they show a clip of Bedtime for Bonzo, and then they show the Gipper, and then they show him...
Shout out Monkey Club.
Exactly. And then they show him in the Oval Office. It's like, hey.
Yeah. That's, like, a Big Short level of distillation of history. Just, like, you think you could tell the Gipper that he couldn't have a war that he wanted? Good luck. And, like, he creates a war that everyone was like, don't do that. Please don't do that. He's like, we're going to war. It's like, well, no, stop it. But yeah, I mean, in like, what is that, probably 45 seconds, maybe a minute, it just tells that entire thing.
Yeah.
Almost like, you know, Margot Robbie in the bathtub, right? It's just like, let me explain this wildly complex thing to you so you have the context for the movie, right? And
yeah.
In the very beginning, Cruz causing turbulence because he's bored. Like, his co-pilot's asleep or whatever, and he turns off autopilot and then, like, yanks the thing. It's like, sorry, folks, a little bit of turbulence. Just, like,
also
crazy.
Shows, like, what a great pilot he must be. Like, that's what I also got out of that, is, like, he is able to do all that without batting an eye or whatever. Like, he's half asleep. And we see him, you know, as a character, like, the piloting he needs to be able to do is pretty top-notch anyway, so I was like, wow.
It also shouldn't come as a surprise that because Tom Cruise is a licensed, qualified pilot, he did all of his flying scenes in this movie.
Oh, okay. I figured.
Which, yeah, I mean, other actors, you're like, oh, there's no way, like, that's just, you know, a double, they're pulling the car or whatever, but with him, it's like, if you said that he wasn't flying the plane, I'd be like, well, why not?
Right? He's mostly in a car with wings, like, it's a little, it's not a little, it's one of those, like, biplanes, you know?
Yeah.
Mostly, so, like, I could see him, I mean, we could probably have learned to flown one of those in our lifetimes. Like, I could never trust myself behind a jumbo jet.
I do like, for this movie, another movie in a row where Cruz gets his ass beat when he when he's down with the cartel. And
are you missing a tooth, Barry?
Yeah. and then he goes home and his wife's like, you're missing a tooth. He's like, yeah, don't worry about it, we gotta move. He doesn't wind up winning, and again, I kind of glossed over in the intro, but he dies again in this movie. He doesn't really win, but he kind of wins until he loses, yet he still gets his ass beat, I guess, by either the criminals, like the fellow inmates in that jail, or by the cops when they arrested him, right? Like, look at this stupid gringo.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, but he has to take that beating, but he had to have, like that's, like, you know, as far as the movie's telling us, you know, most of the rest of his life was lavish and very good. So he had to take, like, that one beating as far as the movie goes.
Like, wouldn't you, like, if you had all that money and a beautiful wife and, like, all the money and, like, all the power in the world and, like, you had the CIA in your back pocket, I would get my ass kicked once for that. Why not?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I lose one tooth.
I also think it was a very meta moment where the freedom fighters, he brings all the guns. They're like, we don't give a shit about guns. We want your sunglasses. And I was like, oh, of course they want Tom Cruise's sunglasses. Like, that's very iconic. Like, how could you not?
Great catch. I don't think I caught that. I don't think I definitely did not think that watching it.
We also have two shots, and I think this is something you brought up in a recent episode. We have two shots of Cruise's butt. Like, is he just showing his butt as he gets older?
He mooned us in this movie,
twice.
But one was, like, intentional, wasn't it? And one was just whatever. But, like, once he, like, literally moons his wife and you see it.
Let's see here. He's reading Al Capone's biography, which is not really necessarily, I mean, I guess it's hubris there too. Timely as we record this a couple weeks ago as this comes out, because there's that new Josh Trank Al Capone movie with Tom Hardy, which is apparently not good.
No, I can't wait to see it.
I like when Cruz goes to the bank and they're like, let me show you something. And he's like, look at this auxiliary vault we're buying or we're building. He's like, oh, you're doing this for my money? He's like, no. This is for the rest of the town. You get the main vault. We're like, oh, like, he's got a lot of money.
That was great. Thought I recognized that bank teller for something, probably like a Marvel thing or something or other, but I wish he as well had a bigger role, because I thought, like, for sure the bank manager and Tom Cruise were going to have, like, a couple scenes together. They must have filmed a few, but it looks like they filmed a lot more, because they, like, so much of this is montaged together, which I'm not complaining. Like, I love it. I think it's really well done, but, like, it feels like they took a lot of full scenes and clipped them down.
Because there's that local cop or whatever who's, like, I don't know what he is. He might be ATF, he might be whatever, like, one of the guys. There's that guy who's, like, doing this paperwork, and he's like, there's a lot of money in Mina, and, like, is that just so that they have another office converging on the hangar? Like, it doesn't feel like he gets a short shrift too.
That was so weird, because I thought that was the accountant for the CIA, but it turns out to be the accountant for the FBI. He's in town tracking the money, going like, what the hell, this town's blowing up. But you're right, we get, like, two, three shots of him, and then he shows up, like, 20 minutes later busting him at the hangar again. So, like, they definitely cut out his whole storyline.
Because so you have him in the office getting the assignment. You have him getting into town and seeing, like, crazy sports cars drive by while it's, like, this, like, podunk little town. And then you have the FBI show up, and it's like, well, we didn't need those first two scenes. Like, you could just have, like, I don't think anybody would bat an eye if, like, we didn't see the FBI investigation and then the FBI shows up. Like, we don't need to know that he's wanted by the FBI. Like, we can just infer that he's doing lots of bad shit. Like, everybody knows him. Of course they do.
It's also funny, too, after the fact that he gets pissed that his brother-in-law buys that shitty little gremlin car. But yet, like, it seems everyone working for him is in, like, American Muscle, like, just, you know, cruising down the block while, like, you know, homeless people are checking for change in the payphones.
And what I think is very funny, maybe not very funny, but funny, is that Caleb Landry Jones is the only person in this movie doing, or the only one on our team, the criminal team, right, who's doing honest work. Like, he's sweeping up, he's doing all the bitch work, he's doing all the grunt work, all the Charlie work, and he's not allowed to, like, reap the benefits of his labor because, like, his sister, Cruz's wife, says no? Like, it feels weird. I mean, I know he's a screw-up, but I feel like you maybe could have, I don't know, I guess he was always going to screw up.
Well, I mean, he might not even have been that much of a screw-up. I mean, he ends up being one because he, you know, it seems like he's not really, I don't know, it seems like Tom Cruise, like, he has made up his mind immediately, but yet, like, if he had just, you know, shared the wealth a little, maybe, why couldn't he have bought him a modest car or given him, you know, a couple extra bucks? Then he wouldn't have had to have stolen an entire suitcase. But once he gets it, his judgment is not the best, just walking into a diner with a briefcase full of money. What was he gonna do? Buy everything on the menu?
I don't know. He grabs, like, a wad of money, like, way too much money for whatever he wants, and then he goes back to the car and gets the entire briefcase full of money where money is sticking out of it. And it doesn't feel like it's sticking out of it to, like, let the audience know what's in there. It's, like, just because he's a mess, right? So, I don't know.
Right.
The only other note that I wrote down, and there's some trivia, is that at the end, when Cruz is, like, at the White House, basically, and they're just, everybody's around him, and they're trying to figure out what to do next, he's like, why am I in the room? Because I'm the gringo that always delivers. And I'm like, all right, cool line.
That's the line.
Oh, so this is funny. So Tom Cruise, director Doug Liman, and screenwriter Gary Spinelli all lived together in the house that was used for filming. They all did daily chores, and Cruise obtained a separate section of the refrigerator because he didn't want his food contaminated by Lyman's, quote, junk.
So wait, they lived in the pink house?
I guess so.
That's hilarious.
Which is kind of amazing. This is the first Tom Cruise movie in 9 years since Tropic Thunder to be R-rated.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. Like, this pretty hard R.
So right now, if you want to, I mean, I think you need a cable subscription, but if it's, this is free to watch on FX Now, which is a service I had never used before, but I just, instead of paying $4 to rent it or whatever, it's on FX. Now you have to validate or verify in the beginning, because it's like the same voice on FX, just like, this is rated TVMA, language, sex, like, it's all, it's like this blah, 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 like all these different things that are like, you're about to see some really dark shit. Like, just like, get ready for it. So yeah, definitely a hard R there.
Was it on Watchmen where there was like the parental warning?
Yes.
It went on forever and ever.
So I mentioned Sarah Wright before, who plays his wife. She's 21 years younger than Tom Cruise, because of course, like,
naturally,
I feel like that's also the Vin Diesel, Dominic Toretto, like, where he's playing 15 years younger because he can kind of pass for it, but not really.
But I was thinking too, it's like back to that pilot thing where it's like trophy wife because I'm a pilot, just because, you know, it's a thing. But also, like, he was living the life. Like, it's too bad. I mean, obviously he was bored and shit, but like, he could have taken up a hobby and stuff, but it seemed like he had the perfect life before this all went down. Like, I would have almost have been like, if it was me and Domhnall Gleeson was like, I caught you smuggling cigars, I'd be like, how much time do I have to do? Because I'm not coming to work for you guys. That never works out right.
I mean, his wife in real life was very pretty, but, I mean, she's not Sarah Wright pretty, but also Sarah Wright has the benefit of, like, professional hair and makeup, and you know what I mean? Like, but here, I'm going to send this picture to you.
Oh, what'd you think of Cruz's slight accent?
I liked it. I mean, I think also in that vein, we also have him speaking Spanish, and I also think this movie did a really interesting job of not subtitling easy Spanish. Like, it feels more natural that, like, we all pretty much understand what these words mean. We don't need to subtitle. Like, when people have to recite things, like, you know, they're like, all good, Barry? Like, all good, Barry? Like, they subtitle the second time, because he's like, I didn't pick up on it. You know what I mean? But I think this movie smartly treats, you know, language and accents pretty well.
What is this Answers Africa thing you just said?
No, that's Barry Seal's wife.
Oh, okay.
In real life.
Oh, she's not blonde at all.
No. The only other trivia that I have is that Domhnall Gleeson's father, Brendan Gleeson, was in both Far and Away, Mission Impossible 2, and Edge of Tomorrow. So this is the fourth time that Cruise has worked with Gleason, just the first time he's worked with Domhall.
Oh, and he was also in Paddington 2, one of your favorite movies.
Yes. We just watched the original Italian Job for Too Fast, Too Forever, and it feels like there's a prison in that movie that like is basically the Paddington 2 prison. I was like, Joe, I don't know if it's the same prison, but it looks like the same prison, and like it's where Mr. Bridger's like dancing through, and I'm like, it's a song and dance number whenever they're in that prison. It's just like, this is just a wonderful, I guess, a wonderful prison to be.
Patrick McGoohan as the warden.
Oh, man.
So good.
All right, so Mike, very important question. If Tom Hanks were cast in this role, do you think Tom Hanks could play Barry Seal, or if not, who could he play?
I actually think Hanks could have played this if they made this like around the time of like Apollo. If they made it then, definitely could have pulled it off. I think it's a little too late. I think just Cruise has the benefit of being, you know, a little bit of like a cyborg, a little inhuman, just like being in peak physical condition at all times.
Oh, there is a joke. There's a joke on the series finale of Brockmire about Tom Cruise, because it's do you know about Brockmire? Are you watching it? Are you familiar with Brockmire?
It's the Hank Azaria show, but I haven't seen it, right?
Yeah, so he's a sports announcer, and he just starts in like, he has a fall from grace before the series starts. He starts doing small town, you know, minor league baseball announcing, works his way back up to the majors. Final season, the fourth season, jumps 10 years ahead. So we're like in the future of baseball, the future of society. And in that point, they make a joke about Tom Cruise replacing all of his organs every 6 months. Just like, I gotta stay young.
Yep.
So I thought that was pretty funny. What you were saying, that because Tom Cruise never let himself get out of shape. Like, I feel like Hanks has let himself get out of shape for roles because Cruise has basically, you know, stayed looking young to be a movie star as opposed to just, like, playing incredible parts, right? Like, it's a different track you took.
Because how old was this character supposed to be during all this? Like, his 30s, his 40s? Like, how old was this guy when this is going on? Because I'm like, this would have been a crazy Chris Pine role. Like, that would have been amazing. Like, you know, I love Cruise here, don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying, like, I started saying, like, you know, you could have definitely given this to someone and they would have just, like, wherever they were at the time, it would have just catapulted their career into the stratosphere.
He was 46 when he was killed, so he was between 38 and 46.
Yeah, so you could have gotten, like, a Chris to do this. One of the Hollywood Chrises could have stepped up and done this, too, and everything. But, like, yeah, I think it's
But 2017, you know, Hanks, you don't think so?
I don't think so. Unfortunately, no.
What other role could he play?
Escobar?
No. that would be crazy.
That would be a real Vinny Chase situation.
I do want to say that, like, we basically saw this movie kind of in Hanks' filmography already. Like, this is Catch Me If You Can. Like, Cruise is the Leo part.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned it earlier and stuff, but, like, absolutely. Like, just the idea of, you know, the CIA and, you know, having someone, you know, eluding the CIA, but then even at the end of that movie, working for the people who were trying to catch you and all that kind of... Yeah, definitely.
Does Tom Cruise run in this movie? I'm sure he does a couple times, but I know one specifically is when he chases after the gremlin right before it explodes.
Yeah.
Does he run any other time?
I think he starts running when they're invading the mansion, when like the Federales come right before he's thrown in jail and everyone's like, stay here, it's all right. And then I think he starts running there, but not for sure.
And then, of course, we found Harperfect on Twitter, who said you could replace... I wonder if Harperfect knows... Probably not. We found Harperfect on Twitter, who said you could replace Tom Cruise's name in any movie with the name Lightning McQueen and not a thing would change. Could Barry Seal, not CIA, be named Lightning McQueen? I don't see why not.
I wouldn't be surprised if some people actually refer to him as Lightning.
Right? Like, if nickname. He's called El Gordo in real life, he might as well be called Lightning in the movie.
Plus, Lightning's white, and he's white, and, like, it would be a funny sort of nickname for a gringo. I don't know. It just makes kind of, like, all kinds of sense.
Yeah.
Well, I guess Lightning can also be, like, purple and yellow, too. So I don't want to, you know, whatever.
Yeah, don't want to... Let's not be racist about Lightning.
Exactly.
All right. The Golden Couches, the Cruisies. Is there anything in American Made that we could name the awards after? The Golden Pilot Wings? The Pilot Wings? The Golden Wings?
Probably not. No, it'd have to be, like, something to do with drugs or something, or...
I'm just thinking, like, he's a pilot in this, and he's a pilot in Top Gun, and I'm wondering if...
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Like, I don't love that, but there's at least there's a thematic connection there.
The Golden Landing Gear? that kind of rolls off the tongue a little bit.
Like, the Golden Couches, no offense to Kate. I love Kate. I'm not a huge fan of the Golden Couches. I think the Cruisies is probably better, but we still got time. We still got one more movie. Yeah. Maybe we'll figure it out, or we won't.
What's kind of nice about the Cruisies, I think that'll be the first time we use the actor's actual name in the award. Whereas, like, every other award show, it was based on, like, you know, the hot dogs, the peaches, the this,
the reason
the
I thought of it was because for Zack Attack, we did the Zeffies. So we called them Zeff. We called it the Zeffies. So that's actually what inspired it. But okay. Yeah, because that, I think we were boxing ourselves in, because I feel like the Cruisies is right there for the taking, right? So
it's starting to really rub off on me. I like it.
Yeah. Best film, yes or no? I mean, we're gonna have to cut this down because there's a bunch on here, but is this one of Tom Cruise's, say, 10 best movies?
I mean, I think so. I mean, it's right. One of my does it count if it's one of, like, my favorite Tom Cruise movies?
We could put it on there, and then okay. You know, in reality, you and I are going to sit down very soon and just cut all these down, so it might get cut okay. very shortly, but we can, for now, absolutely.
All right.
It's on the short list. It's on the short list for the short list. Best Cruise role. Barry Seal, yes or no?
Who else is on? I mean, I want to say yes, but, like, I feel like he's getting wedged out by a couple other...
We'll put him on there for now, and then okay. we'll come back to it.
I just want to say, like, yes for everything.
It's not no, right? It's not no.
Right.
Most badass role, I'm going to say no. He's, like, the opposite of being a badass in this movie.
Okay.
Most daring role to take, no. Mm-hmm. Best fight, we don't even see the one fight where he gets his ass kicked, so no. Best theme song, soundtrack, score. I feel like there could have been more, like, the funky opening is great, but I don't remember music otherwise, do you?
I mean, there's a lot of, like, period music that they use throughout here, like a lot of good sort of classic rock and everything, but there's no, like, score or any particular song they use as, like, a theme that sticks out.
Best vehicle chase race. I'm just going to say landing a plane in suburbia in American Made, right? Best dance scene, no. Best cruise outfit wardrobe. Do we want to say being covered in cocaine? Is that an outfit?
It counts for me if it counts for you, but I'm leaving it in your hands.
Best sunglasses. Again, cool, but not necessarily memorable, right?
Right.
Best death, killed by the cartel. Best line, I'm the gringo that always delivers.
I mean, it's pretty good. I mean, it's the line of the movie, so I guess if it's any line, it's going to be that one.
I do not envy future us in terms of having to call these down, because there's so many lines here.
Oh, I'll be brutal. Nothing sacred.
Best freak out? No, I don't think.
He's, like, freaking out the whole movie, right? So it's hard to, like, pinpoint a specific freak out moment.
Right. Best sex scene? Yes. We haven't had a best sex scene in a long time.
Absolutely.
But zero G sex in American Made. That could win it all. I mean, I don't think the fans are going to vote for it, but, like, we might. Most athletic feat?
I mean, no? He's flying the airplanes and stuff. I guess, you know, if John Travolta can do it, I guess it's not that.
Best running scene, no. Best or worst love story? I feel like it's not...
Nah.
It has the potential to be really fun. It has the potential to break really bad, but I think it just kind of... It serves the story.
Yeah, it doesn't really focus on it. It's just a component.
And now here, I know this is, you know, like we were talking about before, this is kind of just the Tom Cruise show, but best ensemble or best non-Cruise actor, male or female, do we want to nominate? Like, the ensemble is great, but they don't have a ton to do, right? And I don't know, even, like, if we put Domhnall Gleeson up against, you know, Cruise's best male co-stars or Sarah Wright, like, they're really good in the movie, but there's not a lot of them, right? So it'll have to settle for, as of right now, 7 nominations. Best film, best role, best vehicle chase race, best outfit wardrobe, best death, best line, and best sex scene.
All right.
Cool.
Sounds
not
good.
Not bad. Mike, as this episode comes out on June 5th, happy June, our first episode in June.
Woo-hoo.
Also today on Hanks for the Memories, the other Tom Club podcast, go check that one out. We have The Great Buck Howard, a movie that I think I incorrectly last time said Tom Hanks directed. He did not direct. He's just in a small part. But his son, Colin Hanks, is one of the two leads with John Malkovich. So go check that out. And then next week, of course, we've got Mission Impossible Fallout, the final, for now, Tom Cruise movie. And then on Hanks for the Memories next week, Mike, we're going another literary adventure.
Oh, boy.
Angels and Demons.
We're back at it.
Back at it.
More cryptics, more codes of all that Bible stuff. Get ready for an adventure. I was trying there.
It kind of worked. So, you know, I appreciate the effort. Well, for all things Cruise Club and Hanks the Memories and all 27 shows in the network, including Third Time's a Charm, you go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, run, at cageclub.me. Come back, like I said, next time for Mission Impossible Fallout. Check out every Friday Hanks for the Memories. High School Slumber Party, and for now, also Too Fast, Too Forever. We're winding down. We've got, I think, next week, and then three more episodes in a row, a couple weeks off, and then the Cruisies, or whatever, TBD Awards. But
Cruisies.
We're nearing the end.
I like Cruisies. It's really sticking.
Cool. I hope it does. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And we'll see you next time, right here on Cruise Club.